Donald Trump said he hasn't quite decided about sending Tomahawk missiles. I suppose he'd give them to NATO. NATO would hand them over to Ukraine. Is there anything different between that and us giving them directly to Ukraine? Russia says, listen, that'll be the end of any relationship we have left if you do that, because apparently the Tomahawks have a range that might allow Ukraine to hit Moscow.
Yeah, they have some variants. There's different variants have range of up to 1,500 miles, which is like three or four times longer than even the ATACMs that we have for the regular long-range missiles. But this one is a bit more problematic. You can't just give these missiles to Ukraine. They require to be fired from either strategic bombers that Ukraine doesn't have, from hard silos or systems that are called the Typhoon that only we have, and there's only a few of them, or ballistic missile submarines. So Ukraine doesn't have very many of those, as I recall. So for these to be used, it could only be done expressly by American military, which is why Russia is reacting much more strongly to this one, because only American military in all facets of the launch cycle would be doing this, and then it would be a direct attack by the United States into Russia. And that's why they are saying, no, this is not like F-16s or ATACMs or HIMARS or any of those other things. This one's different, and this is not some place we need to go. It will not, let me just categorically state, it will not change the course of the war, but it could be a provocation for escalation. Not a good move.
And it is rather disturbing, because I've heard you make comments like that before, and I've heard others make the same comments. It's just not a pervasive point. People just talk about, are we going to give Tomahawk missiles either indirectly or directly? You think it's just like a shipment of a box, you give it to them and they can launch them. The fact that it will absolutely require American military personnel and American military hardware that Ukraine does not operate, that clearly implicates us directly. It's like boots on the ground kind of activity. How do you think Russia would respond to that? I know World War III is certainly a possibility, but short of like declaring war on the United States, what would their sort of militarily appropriate action be, Daniel Davis?
One of the things we've seen pretty consistently from Russia throughout is that things that we would ordinarily consider acts of war, and if people did to us, we'd lose our minds and we would be attacking somebody the next hour. Russia has shown much more sober mind viewpoint on this, and they have not taken action that would then precipitate an expansion of the war directly into NATO. Too many people in the West, I think, say because Russia never has up to that point, then there's literally anything we can do, and there will be a catastrophic response. I'm not sure that that's going to always be a safe bet, because we just never know how far we can push Russia until finally there is a red line beyond which they won't. And they're being pretty calm, pretty aggressive on talking about this one. But I don't know if even this would result in it, because they would see it's not going to change the outcome, and they still have a path to a military victory over Ukraine. So I would wager that they probably would not start a war with us, because then that would undo nearly everything that they have done and put them into this massive fight. It would be horrible for us, because now then we would be targets when we haven't been before. So it would be stupid to the highest degree. But I would bet that Russia is not going to start a war even if we do this. But they may do something else indirectly, like against our interest elsewhere in the world, which won't be good.
Well, and there always is at some point a straw that will break the camel's back. So whether or not this is going to do it or not, I guess the most important point on this is giving the Tomahawk missiles, whether you and I are operating them or they can operate them on their own, is not going to help them militarily. It's a pointless effort.
That is my frustration. Why take the risk? Why find out, is this the red line beyond which they won't be pushed, or will they go past this one too, when it won't change the outcome? It won't make Ukraine win. It won't make Russia lose, but it will put us at risk. And so then what is the point of doing it? And by the way, we don't even have too many of these of our own. Why do I want to dwindle down my own stockpile when we could really use those if we get into a war, say, with China or Russia in the future? We need to hold on to those.
Another outstanding point, which is pretty much the case with all military hardware we're talking about. Daniel Davis, Deep Dive. Find him where you get your podcast. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. Great food for thought today. As always, I love you, man. We'll talk next Tuesday. Have a great week.
My pleasure. Have a good one, Brian.
Take care, brother. Coming up at 8:42, 55 KRCD Talk Station. We're going to learn about breast cancer. It's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. OHC Doc. Going to be joined. It's 2 years since the attack on Israel. They had 1,200 people killed and 250 hostages taken. It's reported they have 48, and Israel says, well, we only think 20 of them are still alive. But a critical negotiation point as we enter the sit-down discussions, or rather informal ones, you can tell us what's going on with that. I thought the initial predicate was, well, we'll stop fighting when you release the hostages. Is Hamas presented with a stumbling block because maybe a lot of them, maybe all of them are not even alive? I know the family members would want the bodies returned, but do they have anything to really turn over anymore?
No, I think they do. That's certainly been the case. They've been pretty open about how many are alive and how many are not. So I certainly hope that's the case. That would be a pretty cruel twist if there was really none alive at all. But you couldn't hide that. So if you want the war to come to an end, that would be a problem. And by having some alive, that's always been one of their very few, if not only, negotiating cards that they could play. And if they didn't have those, then once that became apparent, then there would be no reason for Israel to do anything except just, put the floor, gas to the floor, et cetera, and drive in militarily. So I don't think that they would do that. But we'll find out pretty soon. In fact, right now there is meetings going on in Egypt for the second day in a row to try to bring an end to this. And to your point a minute ago, there was no specific connection to the fighting will stop as soon as the hostages are released. In fact, President Trump has repeatedly asked, since he made this announcement a couple of days ago, that he wants Israel to stop shooting right now while the negotiations to get the hostages back and all the other terms so that we can bring an end to the war. But Israel has not done that. And so the fighting continues to go on as well, and the negotiations continue simultaneously.
Well, I hate to attempt to draw parallels with Russia and Ukraine, but Israel has made some, I know it's been bloody, and some may argue it's immoral or whatever. Whatever your position is relative to Israel going after Gaza, they've obviously taken over a lot of land. They've recaptured some. They've destroyed some of the infrastructure. They're, quote unquote, winning. Noting the civilian casualties, they're winning and making progress in Gaza, much in the same way Russia continues to win and make progress in Ukraine. Considering you mentioned the hostages are about the only bargaining chip Hamas has, are we looking at kind of a comparable thing? They're in a sense of maybe denial about the relative strength. I mean, are they planning on fighting till the last man is standing? What are their options for Hamas?
Yeah, I think that in some ways the parallels are there, as you mentioned. I mean, there is one side has a decisive advantage over the other, and one wants to have negotiations while they're fighting, one wants to have no negotiations. But other than that, there's some pretty big differences, too, in that I don't think that there's anything militarily left to accomplish for Israel. They're just blowing stuff up. And I'm not sure how that's useful to their objectives, because you can't literally kill your way to victory in here. Right. They went from the north, shortly after 10/7, which is today's the 2-year anniversary, that all the way down through Rafah, all the way down to the Egyptian gate. And then they kind of started over. So now then they're moving south again. And there's almost nothing but, whatever's left of not rubble, they're turning that into rubble now. But there's no actual combat actions going on, so it's kind of just blowing a bunch of stuff up. And the Palestinian people are the huge losers in all of this, whether it's Hamas doing stuff that's dragging their feet on a negotiation, whether it's the Israeli Defense Forces firing into stuff that has no apparent military value. I don't know, but I do know that those people are suffering, and I hope for everybody's sake there this war comes to an end very, very quickly.
Okay, now if Israel continues down its current path and achieves, you said they've already achieved military victory, but they do whatever they think they need to do in the area. But does that mean they're going to be an occupying force on a going forward basis? And what's that going to look like for Israel going forward?
Yeah, that's one of the big sticking points that's actually preventing the accomplishment right now, is the definition on what these points mean. These 20 points that President Trump's team came up with, that Israel says they agreed to, but then when you heard what Benjamin Netanyahu said after the press conference with Trump, there were some pretty big differences, and you just touched on one of them. Whereas the Trump plan said that there would be an independent force, possibly an Arab force that everyone would agree to, that would provide security, that would train a new Palestinian police force to keep civil security, et cetera. But then Benjamin Netanyahu said, we will provide security indefinitely. He didn't even put a potential endpoint on it. He just said, that's what we're going to do. So those are huge, huge differences. And I think part of what the Hamas negotiators are trying to figure out right now, and to try to assess what actually is the definition of who's going to do what? What will be the withdrawal lines? What will be the withdrawal timelines, et cetera? Because Hamas has categorically said, we will stop fighting, we will return all the hostages, and we will leave and lay down our arms. So they have said yes to the major issues, but the execution of the other details is a big sticking point so far.
Well, and being a member of Hamas and saying, okay, we'll vacate the territory doesn't mean that the ideas that are shared, that Hamas has, the idea that Israel's evil from the river to the sea, the concepts that, you know, are that really make up what Hamas is all about, the hearts and minds of the people might still be wed to those philosophies. We've talked about this before. You can't kill your way into winning the hearts and minds of people.
Well, listen, there's some pretty hard things that everybody's going to have to face here. Number one, it's the term Hamas is just a tag that we use. But
right.
When you, as a people, have been starved, have been bombed, and have the entire infrastructure razed to the ground, that's not going to engender a lot of positive thoughts toward the occupying power, the power that did that. So I don't know how you erase that. That's one of the things that Benjamin Netanyahu said is a prerequisite for all of this, is that there be a basically a re-education program and retraining, you know, to teach the new children from the Hamas, from the Palestinians, et cetera. But honestly, that's I think an impossible ask.
Yeah.
But you can't tell the people, don't feel bad about what we did because of all this stuff. I don't know how you square this circle.
Maybe subject everyone to a mind control experiment a la like a Clockwork Orange, where you tie them down and you brainwash them and then they submit to your ideology. There's an answer, but no, that's not going to happen. All right. Well, I guess real quick on if Israel is not the one providing the security, they have an army. We must acknowledge they're at least in a position to make an argument that they're capable of doing that. And I understand all the objections to it. Don't get me wrong. Who would be that force? Because it seems to me that you're going to have the necessity is going to be some sort of peacekeeping force, like law enforcement officers. Who's going to do that? The blue hair, the light blue hats aren't going to do that.
No, and if that's one of the things they're talking about right now, and there is a path here that could be positive and could help out, because one of the President Trump's, you know, signature ideals and things that he wants, as well as Israel, Netanyahu, is that they want the expansion of the Abraham Accords. So
right.
This could be an opportunity to say, hey, some of these countries that we want to have good relations with and some that we already do, let's have some of the troops from theirs who would be, you know, honest brokers between and respected by both parties. So there is a possibility here as opposed to the blue hats you mentioned.
You know what? That's a sound and logical proposal as it initially hits me. I like that. You know, you have fellow Middle Eastern countries providing the stability they need, and they're not pro-Israel or pro-Hamas. They just live in that area, and they want some peace and sensibility and trading partners so they can all live happily ever after. Right? Let's keep that in mind as a potential solution to the problem.